not looking. The outer worlds are no threat to us, and expending the effort to bring them to heel will waste time for little gain. Two, they are expendable in the eyes of our foes. Besides raw resources, they hold little military value. So, I will make them gifts to my subordinates. As we advance towards the core, our more distractible brothers will break off to take slaves and build pyramids of skulls, as is their wont. Their foolishness will not hinder us. Indeed, they will help us by cutting the enemy's lines of supply. Lacrimus smiled thinly.
I see your game. You seek to prevent others from following Calibor's path. You offer them easy glory to fill their souls.
Is that so wrong, brother? Imandum asked. This way they are of use.
You are a coward,
Imandum snorted. If you believe that, you would have already made your move, rather than allowing Calibor to test the waters for you.
I had nothing to do with that.
Imandum laughed. As you like.
Why Pergo?
Imandum paused. A commander must be seen to take the field on occasion.
Yes, but why that field in particular?
Imandum frowned. Speak plainly, brother. What exactly are you accusing me of?
I have heard your reasons for laying siege to this world. It is a waste of time, in my opinion. But I understand your intent. A wise warrior learns his limits before attempting to exceed them.
Lacrimhugh gazed at the projection.
But I know you well enough by now to know that you must have some other goal. So I ask you plainly, why Pergo?
Imandum hesitated. At times, he forgot how clever Lacrimhugh could be, when his temper was held in check. It was what made the Dark Apostle so dangerous. The Apostolic Libraria, a repository of ecclesiarchal wisdom, he said finally. One of them, at least. Imagine having written so much about the gods and their worship that you needed a second world just to house the books. Or 100.
Blasphemy,
Lacrimhugh said with a thin smile. Depends entirely on your perspective, I suppose. Imandum gazed at the rune representing the city. This system belongs not to industrious craftsmen or warmongers, but to clergy. Hoarders of knowledge and speakers of litany, even as we are. He looked at Lacrimhugh. They are much like us, though we both deny it, he said. Lacrimhugh frowned.
Careful, brother. Jesting aside, that is blasphemy.
Imandum grinned. He could hear the ire in the other word-bearer's voice. You know, some say that they use a corrupted version of the Urizen's own words to guide their false church, that they built their self-righteous fortress atop foundations made from the bones of cultures. What do you think of that, brother?
I think it is ridiculous. They are weak. If they followed the word of Lorgar, they wouldn't be. We would not prey upon them as we do.
It must not be, and so it is not, eh?
That is the way of all things, brother,
Lacrimhugh said sanctimoniously. He sniffed.
All of this, then, so that you can burn a few books?
He laughed harshly.
Is that your idea of a suitable offering to the gods?
Do you know what I was before we first set our feet on the path of enlightenment? Imandum gestured to himself. I was an iconoclast, brother. I rode wings of fire and plied my axe rig against the wisdom of ages. He knocked a knuckle against his grey shoulder plate. I was part of the Ashen Circle. It was my privilege to murder the history and culture of a people, all in the name of the Urizen. And I do the same here and now.
Nostalgia, then,
Lacrimhugh said dismissively.
The bane of many a warrior. Somehow, I thought you above such things.
Imandum smiled sadly. How one so wise can understand so little. He turned, hand sweeping out to indicate the projection. This, brother, is the heart of them. He shook his head. Our enemy values this place more than 100 Forge worlds. Trust me on this. Destroying this world makes a statement. It makes our intentions clear and draws the eyes of the gods to us, while at the same time weakening the resolve of our foes. All strategic gains. And, of course, it would lend us new allies. Lacomhue glared at him.
What new allies are you talking about?
Ermatnam scrawled through reams of information with a wave of his hand. I have studied thousands of hours of data and correlated 16 points of interest in the immediate area. These are the major trade lanes for this part of the system. And these, he gestured, and several points on the map were illuminated. These are sites of pirate activity.
Pirates?
Lacomhue said, puzzled. Yes, Ermatnam said, smiling. Reinforcements, you could call them.
We have a fleet. What do we need with a few ragged pirates?
The orbital defences of Almes will be of a margin greater than those possessed by this world. We have neither the numbers nor the fortitude to plough through them, as we will do here. Lacomhue grunted in sudden understanding.
You intend to herd them before us, like chattel.
If needs must. But they may well have more uses than that. Pirates have haunted the wild spaces of this system for generations. They may know of ways to penetrate defences, or secret routes by which we might avoid detection. Failing that, they will serve as a ready-made shield to allow us to close with the enemy and gut them.
And why would they do this? Pirates are not soldiers. They do not serve the gods as we do.
Perhaps not. But in time, they might. If we show them the rewards that await them in service to the Pantheon and the Urizen. Burning Pergo, spitting on the colours of those who have hunted them, will go a long way to convincing them. Regardless, they will come in handy when it comes time to lay siege to Almes.
And why must we lay siege at all, eh?
Lacomhue glared at him.
Why must we do this? Why fight in the mud when we sail the stars?
I have told you, brother, the gods will it.
If they do, they have not said so to me.
Ermatnam turned back to the map. Maybe you are not listening, brother. Clear some of those hymns from your ears, and maybe you'll be able to hear them. Lacomhue paused, as if chewing over some problem. Then,
I have been thinking about your speech from before. Pretty as it was, I find myself puzzled.
A common occurrence, I suspect. Lacomhue didn't rise to the bait. Ermatnam gestured for him to continue. The Dark Apostle cleared his throat.
We both know that what we seek is not what you claimed. If it were, our masters would be here, not us.
Ermatnam frowned. Perhaps. He sighed and ran a hand over his pate. There was truth amid the hyperbole. We are broken. Not as badly as Fulgrim's lackeys, or so thoroughly as Angron's curs, but we bend beneath the weight of our own hubris. Surely you must see that as well as I. Lacomhue looked away.
We remained a legion while others crumbled.
Did we? I think we are a legion in name only. The Urizen is silent. Our wars are fought at the behest of others, and those who lead us spend more time fighting each other than our true foes. Ermatnam shook his head. We are broken, brother. We simply do not realize it. We must be one again. One faith, one army, one brotherhood. But first, the impure must be purged.
And how do you plan to do that?
Ermatnam looked at him. You know the answer, brother. Lacomhue was silent for a moment. Then he laughed.
I should kill you now.
You've tried already. Or will you continue to insist on the pretense that Calibor wasn't your doing? Ermatnam snorted. No, brother. You won't kill me. If you do, this fleet will crumble, and any hope you have of completing your own quest crumbles with it.
You do think highly of yourself, Amatnim.
Someone must. Amatnim pointed a finger. Erebus is a deceitful snake.
And Corferon isn't.
Corferon is old, and he was the Urizen's mentor. What is Erebus next to that?
He is the hand of destiny, the anointed of the gods.
Is that why he bows to Abaddon? Is that the god's will, do you think? Or is it Erebus, currying favour with one he thinks is mighty enough to protect him when the Urizen returns from his pilgrimage? Lacomhue bared his teeth. Anger flashed in his eyes, and his blade slaves grunted eagerly. They could sense the violence in him, and they slid their swords from their shoulders in readiness. Amatnim stepped back, one hand on his axe rake. Corferon has always been the soul of our legion. His words guided Lorgar, who guided us. Erebus uses us, uses you, for his own advancement. That which I seek will prove him false once and for all. And then he will be cast into the outer dark where he belongs. Lacomhue shook his head.
You continue to speak blasphemy, brother, despite my warnings. Were you any other, I would break you here and leave your carcass as a warning for others.
He pointed his croziers at Amatnim.
But I spare you, because I need you. We shall know which of us is right when the day comes. But until then, I spare you.
Amatnim laughed. As I spare you, brother. He looked back at the projection. I think that moment comes fast upon us, though. My quest nears its end.
And yet we waste time on a library,
Lacomhue said.
Why not simply bombard it from orbit, then, the way we have the others? Why waste time burning it by hand? The same goals would be accomplished, and we would spare our forces unnecessary casualties.
I thought you spoke for the gods, brother. Which do you think they would prefer? This victory must be symbolic, a show of power. Something too great to ignore. He shrugged. Still, I am a faithful man. Let the gods speak, then. I am here, and I listen with great eagerness. He stood patiently, head tilted. When no answer was forthcoming, he sighed and turned to the Dark Apostle. There. I suppose that is plain enough. Now come, brother. Cheer up. It is not every day that you get to burn a repository of falsehood. Chapter 4, 171509, Almes, Primaris Grade Cardinal World. The welcome feast was an ordeal. Calder endured it with the patience of dawn. He chafed at the thought of work going undone, but maintained a facade of polite stoicism. Sabodin and Karos fared better. The Raven Guard had done his best to make himself even more inconspicuous, while Sabodin had gone the opposite route. Like Calder and Karos, the Khan had shed his battleplate. He was clad in thick, colourful robes and a mantle of eagle feathers that draped his broad shoulders. His hair was bound in a neat braid with golden wire, as was his moustache. It contrasted strongly with the dark, plain uniform of unfamiliar design that Karos wore. The Khan padded through the crowded chamber like a tiger on the prowl, haughty and proud. Ecclesiarchal notables scattered before him, and aristocrats trailed in his wake, whispering. There were few of the latter in attendance. The noble families of Almes were a spent force, mostly absorbed by the ecclesiarchy over the centuries, but some remained. They preened like gaudy peacocks amid the crimson tedium of the administratum representatives, or the grey monotony of the administratum bureaucrats. Amongst these warring hues wandered officers of Aemon's bodyguard, looking out of place and uneasy. Calder had tried engaging a few of them in conversation, but they seemed overawed and had little to say. They provided him little refuge from less welcome conversational partners, such as those who now had him cornered. A group of noteworthy individuals, masters of trade and finance, overseers and administratum adepts. A whirlpool of interminable conversation lapped at him. Bureaucrats, deacons and functionaries chattered to each other and him, battering at his walls with incessant questions relating to inanities such as the latest fashions on Macragg or the weather on Ardium. Fortunately, his training had prepared him to endure such things.
"Do you eat, then, my lord?"
a heavy-set man said, drawing Calder's wandering attentions back. The man held a plate filled with foodstuffs, crustaceans, processed grains, slices of the native cheese, and nibbled on something green.
"Nearly, I did not see you partake of the meal earlier."
"Nor did I," an older woman said, looking up at him. Her dress was worth more than the average worker made in their lifetime, and heavy with artificially grown gemstones. Calder could read the signs of multiple juvenile treatments on her too tight flesh.
"Is our humble provender not up to the standards of Holy Terra and Ultramar?"
"My apologies. It has only been 36 standard hours since I last consumed my weekly allotment of nutrient paste," Calder said in a bored tone.
They goggled at him. Calder smiled. A younger man laughed.
"A joke," he said, almost hopefully.
"No,"
Sir Bowden said, appearing behind the young man and startling him. The white scar held a goblet in one hand. It looked absurdly small in his grip.
"The sons of Dorne have no sense of humour. They think it inefficient. I, however, know many jokes."
He leaned towards the older woman, his smile wide and feral.
"Would you like to hear one?"
The mortals scattered like frightened birds. Sir Bowden straightened and chuckled.
"I thought you were a politician, brother. Don't you know how to talk to them?"
"I was talking to them. I did not wish to frighten them."
"And that's your problem, brother. They grow overly familiar."
He took a swig from his goblet.
"They seek to draw us into their petty circles of influence. Can you feel it? Like stepping into a nest of grass vipers."
"It is their nature," Calder said.
"Ha! Ignorance is no excuse for heresy," Sir Bowden said. "They're weighing us, brother. Mark my words, feeling us out, trying to decide how best to make use of our presence. Whether our arrival means Aemon is weak or stronger than he's ever been. Whether the rumors of invasion are true. You can hear them whispering as well as I. It's worse than Ultramar. It's worse than Armageddon, come to that."
"You speak as if Chagoras is free of such things,"
Calder said, as Sir Bowden snagged a decanter from a passing servant. The startled man yelped and fled. Sir Bowden poured himself another goblet of wine and sniffed it.
"Not free, no, and hardly any more subtle, though it pains me to admit it. It is the nature of man to scramble for any advantage when the seasons change."
He took a sip and licked his lips.
"Good vintage," he murmured.
Then,
"I do not blame them, brother, or Aemon for encouraging them, which he is, in his way. It is simply tedious. When your tent burns, do you waste time arguing about how the fire started, or do you put it out?"
"Sound advice. Perhaps we should switch places."
"Oh, no. This is your burden, brother. Bear it in good humour and leave the rest to us."
Sir Bowden drained his goblet and refilled it.
"I'm surprised to see you out of your armour," he said. "Did you have that uniform specially made for the occasion?"
"In a sense,"
Calder said. All Huskarls were provided with the same uniform, tailored to their massive frame. The outfit was black and simple, after the fashion of post-unification Terra, with yellow piping and the chapter sigil pinned to their chest.
"There are occasions when battle play is more hindrance than help."
"True.
Few of our brothers, whatever their chapter, would admit such." "I am not my brothers. Neither, I think, are you."
Sir Bowden snorted.
"You do not know many of us, then.
He smiled.
We laugh as we kill. We find joy in the hunt, in war.
He gestured to his mantle.
This is as much my armor as my battle plate, and this chamber merely another field of war. I am happy here. You sons of Dawn find little joy in anything save your wars. At least, so goes the conventional wisdom.
Calder frowned, but refused to be baited.
Where is Karos? Sampling the local cuisine,
Sir Bowden said, nodding to one of the tables that lined the chamber. Karos hovered near it, peering at the food on display with seeming confusion. He was surrounded by a crowd of chattering nobles, talking around him.
He looks puzzled. An act. Our brother plays up his inhumanity, so that those watching him underestimate him. They think him blind to their jibes and ploys. He is taking their measure, even as we do, in our own ways.
Calder nodded. In that moment, he realized perhaps why Sir Bowden and Karos had been selected to accompany him. Both, like him, had dealt with mortals extensively. Sir Bowden, during the war for Armageddon, and Karos during the Jutton uprisings. Watching them at work, he saw new ways of approaching old problems. Then, that was the Lord Commander's method of operation. Learn by observation. A strong tenet, if a touch more passive than Calder was comfortable with. The Imperial Fists preferred to learn by doing. Wisdom was earned through pain. He found his gaze drawn to the far corner of the chamber, where Aemon sat, surrounded by scribes and advisers. The Cardinal Governor was dressed modestly and speaking to one of his deacons. Sir Bowden followed his look.
What do you make of him? Dedicated. If he is corrupt, he hides it well. He hides it not at all.
Sir Bowden looked around meaningfully.
Then perhaps that is to his credit. He seems willing to listen, which is more than most of them.
He set his goblet aside and upended the decanter, drinking straight from it.
Petty little men and their petty little kingdoms. Sometimes I wonder why we waste time playing the dutiful servants.
Would you rule them then?
No, but it might make things easier.
Sir Bowden glanced up at Calder.
I have heard that Gilliman thinks along the same lines. He intends to set his sons above certain potentates on certain worlds within the Ultramar system, or so I'd heard.
How did you come to hear that?
Sir Bowden tugged on his moustache, grinning.
You think we do not have our eyes and ears in the Crusade? I expect you do as well.
Calder looked away. In point of fact, the chapter did. Something he had been unsettled to learn upon rejoining his brothers. All chapters, especially those with ties to Terra, had their own networks of spies these days. Some were more effective than others. In recent months, Calder had trained his own personal network of scribes, teaching them what to look for and what to disregard in the millions of reports he collected from across a variety of systems.
I know no more about what the Lord Commander intends than you do.
Sir Bowden nodded.
That is not a denial.
Calder glanced at him.
What do your brothers make of it?
Sir Bowden shrugged and took another swig from the decanter.
The Karns have not held a council to discuss it. Indeed, what is there to discuss? Ultramar is his, and the Jean sons of Gilliman obey the edicts of their father, as we would, should the great Karn return from the Hunt of Ages. As would your brothers, should Dawn return.
Gilliman is not Dawn, Calder said.
Nor is he the Great Khan,
Sir Bowden peered at him.
The galaxy rests on a blade's edge, brother, balanced between victory and defeat.
Which side does it tip towards?
I suspect we will not know until the final moment.
Sir Bowden reached up and set a comradely fist on his shoulder. He smiled wildly.
That is the fun of it.
Calder smiled, if only for a moment. It faded a heartbeat later, as Sir Bowden said,
He's hiding something, of course.
Momentarily puzzled, Calder said,
Who? The Lord Commander?
Sir Bowden snorted.
Almost certainly, but no,
our host. He's hiding something. I can smell it on him. He's happy to see us, but it doesn't reach his eyes. He's worried. His world is under threat of invasion. Well, that's not it.
Sabodan snatched a goblet from a passing tray and handed it to him.
Drink! It puts them at ease.
He tugged on his moustache again.
They've all got their secrets, these little men. Can't be a king without a few secrets. Secrets are not my concern. Only the defense of this world.
Admirable. The little king calls for you, brother. Best see what he wants.
Calder turned and saw Aemon looking in their direction. He nodded to Sabodan and made his way to the Cardinal Governor's side. Aemon dismissed his associates with an impatient gesture, and they scattered. One or two of them shot baleful looks at Calder as they went. He pretended not to notice. He'd have to kill them otherwise.
Cardinal Governor,
he said by way of greeting. Aemon gestured. What do you think of it, then?
What?
The wine, Lieutenant. Calder looked down. He'd forgotten he was holding it. The goblet was perplexingly small in his grip. It was not gold, but was decorated to appear so, and deceptively soft. The slightest twitch would serve to crush it. He took a sip of the wine and found it palatable at best. Not to your liking? Aemon asked. The Cardinal Governor was smiling slightly, as if amused by the sight. There are other vintages available.
They would be wasted on me. My body isolates and neutralizes toxins, rendering an issue solely of taste and smell, and I find the taste of fermented grapes somewhat lacking.
He gave the goblet an experimental twitch, but the odor did not alter.
And yet you continue to drink?
One must be polite in mixed company.
Politis, Aemon said.
You sound surprised.
I did not expect it. Your kind are not known for your decorum.
He raised a hand before Calder could speak.
My apologies. That was uncivil. Yes, I was surprised.
He looked down into his own goblet for a moment. Then,
what's he like?
Who?
The Lord Commander Gilliman.
He hesitated.
It is him, isn't it? It's not just propaganda from Terra.
If it were, do you think I would answer honestly?
Aemon frowned and looked away.
I suppose not.
Calder was silent for a moment.
I do not know him, he said. I have met him only once, and then only briefly. But I knelt before him without thinking. Such was the power of him. Though he is not my gene sire, he is of the same materials. They exuded the same strength, the same sublime grace.
His voice grew soft.
Had he ordered me to, I'd have set myself against all the foes of mankind, barehanded and alone.
Aemon took a sip of his wine. Calder noticed that his hand was trembling.
Why did he send you here? Aemon asked.
He was for aid.
No, why you, specifically?
Calder considered the question for a moment. Then,
I am a Huskarl, one of the first for this new era.
He flexed his free hand.
Once, that term was reserved for those chosen to guard our Primarch, both on the battlefield and off. Now, it means something quite different. It is why I was chosen to lead this mission.
You guard worlds rather than lords, Aemon said.
Calder nodded, pleased by the Cardinal Governor's understanding.
We are good at guarding things, and Gilliman is wise enough to allow us to do what we are best at, rather than forcing us into an unsuitable role.
Are there many of you?
Not enough. Never enough. But there will be more before the end of this crusade. We shall build a wall of worlds to hold back the long night, and on each, a single watchman to ward it, come what may. We are Huskarls, and that is our oath.
Aemon was silent for long moments.
Will you be enough, though?
Kanda considered this.
You expected more of us, he said. Perhaps Gilliman himself come down in fire and glory to rescue you from the fiends in the night.
Aemon shook his head. I expected nothing, Lieutenant. Not you, certainly not the risen sun. We are not important as worlds or systems go, and the reach of the ecclesiarchy is not as long as we like to imagine. That Gilliman considered us at all is a blessing from the God Emperor, though some do not see it so charitably. Calder frowned and set his goblet down, gently.
Rebellion?
He asked quietly. He looked around the chamber at the wide array of faces and titles on display. I wouldn't dignify it with that term, no. Aemon damped his lips with his napkin and sat back. Discontent is a more accurate word, I think. I have been soft-hearted. He smiled bitterly. I have shown tolerance for the dissenting and sympathy for the unhappy. I have allowed certain members of the Ecumenical Council to abuse my favour in return to keep the peace on Almace and in the wider system. I have even spared the lives of those aristocratic families that sought to destabilise my position. Calder considered this.
Unwise, he said.
Aemon nodded. Very much so, I expect. The Kabalevskis gave this world to the Ecclesiarchy. Some of their descendants decided that they wanted it back some time ago. Tried every trick in the book to unseat me. I finally had to exile the lot of them. It taught the rest to be quieter about their ambitions, but...
They still seek to undermine you.
Not intentionally, I think, but... Yes. Aemon's smile slipped. Most of them aren't even aware that we've been invaded. They would panic, or worse, incite panic in others.
That is the reason for this feast, then?
A bit of ceremony, before things become awkward. Aemon leaned forward. Some of them will not believe it, even after we tell them. They will assume it is a game on my part, or some attempt to shore up what they consider my faltering regime. Already there are whispers that the Holy Synod is to be petitioned for my removal, and a new dynasty installed. Some believe that the Kabalevskis will return in the world's darkest hour, like the kings of old night. He chuckled and shook his head. I did what was needed. And now I find I can do nothing at all, except wait.
There is much you can do, Cardinal Governor. Yours is the voice which commands. I will need you to use it in the near future. Necessity is a bitter pill for the powerful and the weak alike.
Calder looked down at him.
You are not what I expected, Cardinal Governor. That is to your credit. Do not lose hope now, not when salvation... He's but a handbreadth away.
Aemon nodded. Huskarl, indeed, he said. He turned, and Calder saw a soldier, a junior officer by his insignia, hurrying through the crowd. The man bent respectfully over Aemon's chair and murmured quietly into his ear. Calder was able to hear his words easily enough, however, and when Aemon rose, he wasn't surprised. The enemy has been sighted, Aemon pitched his voice low. As Calder followed the Cardinal Governor from the chamber, he signalled Sabodin and Karos. The time for feasting was over. Scribes and messengers were hurrying through the halls of the Cathedral Palace as they made their way to the Strategium. Scrivener servitors etched lines of ink across reams of parchment as officers spoke to one another in cramped alcoves. There was a sense of anticipation on the air, and not a little fear. "I am told you brought a fleet," Aemon said as they approached the doors. I fear we may need it, weak as our own system defence force is at the moment.
2 strike cruisers and a battle barge, as well as escorts,
Calder said. A small fleet, Aemon said doubtfully.
The silent horseman alone could defend this system,
Sabodin said, his tone betraying his annoyance.
That battle barge weathered the firestorms above Armageddon and burst the heart of an orc rock with its prow.
The Capulus and Raven's valour, while not so large, are equally blooded,
Calder added.
2 strike cruisers and a battle barge are a fleet unto themselves, not counting the dozen frigates that escort them. A better fleet than what you have now, at least,
Sabodin said.
Were the situation different, I might strike your head from your shoulders for such an insult.
Aemon nodded hurriedly, his eyes wide with alarm.
I meant no insult, my lords.
Sir Bowden grunted and looked at Calder. There was a glimmer of cold amusement in the White Scar's eyes, and Calder suddenly realized that Sir Bowden was only pretending to be angry, though he could not fathom why. Perhaps simply for the fun of it.
We take no insult, Calder said, and Aemon gave him a grateful look.
He stopped.
If you could go ahead, Cardinal Governor, I wish to discuss a private matter with the Khan.
He nodded to Carros.
Carros will accompany you.
I shall leave you to it, then.
Aemon paused.
Lieutenant, I do not know whether or not you eat as a man might, but if you would do me the honour, I would like to extend an invitation to break your fast with me tomorrow. I feel there will be much to discuss, and I find I often work best over a meal.
Calder nodded.
I will attend.
Aemon nodded.
Good. I will meet you in the Strategium.
He left them, his bodyguards falling in around him, and Carros following after. Sir Bowden watched them go and chuckled. Calder frowned.
Why the pretense? You noticed.
Sir Bowden sounded pleased.
A man like Aemon needs reminding about our nature every so often.
He tapped his amulets.
They confuse their authority for true power. They cannot be allowed to chastise us, however mildly, and escape censure. Else they will grow bold.
He frowned.
Our brothers, the wolves, made that mistake once. We learn from their errors.
He bared his teeth in a grin.
To? It put you in his good graces. Where he fears me, or Carros, he will cling to you. He should not fear me, then? Not in the same way he fears us. We are wolves prowling in the dark. You are a mastiff, guarding the herd, you see.
Calder shook his head.
I should not have agreed to dine with him.
Sir Bowden stroked his moustache.
Never turn down food when your host offers it. It is rude. Besides, it will aid the illusion that you are on his side. Am I not? You serve the Lord Commander, brother. Last I checked, he wasn't here.
Sir Bowden clapped him on the shoulder.
Come, let us see what games the enemy is playing.
Swordmaster Tyre was waiting for them in the Strategium, along with Canonus Law. He was scowling as data scrawled across the floating projection. He glanced at them as they arrived, and the crowd of officers and scribes surrounding him evaporated at a terse gesture.
A long-range debris trawler spotted them, my lords. It's unmanned, save for an engine seer to keep the servitors functional. Luckily, he's more observant than most of them.
The hololithic image flickered, and a pict feed appeared. It showed a debris field, a graveyard of broken vessels and cosmic junk. Every system had them, places where forgotten things congregated and were picked over by salvagers for anything of value. Tyre pointed at a crimson dot on the feed, a brief flare as of engines firing.
Telemetry indicates that they came out of the debris field here. If they're staying close to the rest of the fleet, that means that it should be here.
A set of coordinates was illuminated.
From that, we've extrapolated the position and formation.
More runes flashed into sight.
What about the trawler? Calder said.
Tyre gestured dismissively.
They destroyed it a few moments after the feed was transmitted.
He frowned.
That's them, though. I'm sure of it. What world is that?
Calder asked.
Pergamon,
Tyre said.
It's one of the larger worlds, a tithe hub. There are orbital dockyards and numerous transit points. Captain Keel is already planning to take the System Defense Fleet out and meet them there. It'll take him a day, maybe two, to reach them. If we can hold them there, it might buy us a few days more.
Pergamon has substantial orbital defenses, Calder said, studying the data.
As I said, it's a tithe hub. There's frequent pirate activity around that area. Two, there's the library.
The library,
Aemon echoed. He closed his eyes.
Holy throne, bless and keep us.
What library is this? Sir Bowden demanded. The Apostolic Libraria, a repository of liturgical texts numbering in the millions,
Calder answered, before Eamon could.
One of the largest of its type in this sector.
Sir Bowden snorted.
Hardly a strategic objective.
It is the most important thing on that planet, Canonus Law said, speaking up for the first time. A commandery of my order guards it, and the sister Dialogus who see to the maintenance of its contents. The texts there are part of the foundation of ecclesiarchal canon, the seeds from which the imperial cult germinated.
They're breaking the pattern, Kara said.
He gestured to the pick captures.
With the other worlds, they employed an Epsilon Montero formation, static wedge, with an emphasis on alternating orbital strikes. They landed few troops, and only after most of the world was on fire. But here... A test run,
Calder said. The others looked at him.
This world is the second largest in the system, and the most well-defended next to Almace.
He paused.
They're practicing.
Practicing? Law snarled. Practicing?
Tyre placed a hand on her shoulder and leaned over to murmur something. She shrugged him off and turned her glare on Eamon.
We must preserve the library, no matter how many lives it costs.
And how do you have me do that, Canonus, when we are here and it is there?
Eamon said.
Captain Keel is taking the fleet. It is in the God Emperor's hands now.
Law bared her teeth.
We have a fleet of ore haulers, of pleasure yachts, and trading vessels in orbit right now. Commandeer them all. My sisters will board them, and we will meet the foe with fire and steel. Even if I could do that, it would take too much time.
He met her glare without faltering. I need you and your sisters here to protect this world and all that it contains.
Calder expected Law to protest further. Instead, she stiffened and turned away.
Pergamon is lost, Eamon said. But its loss can buy us victory. We must begin the work of the final hour and make of Almace a rock which might withstand the tides of abomination.
His voice rang out, and scribes, officers and servants stopped to listen. Calder saw that this too was a test. Eamon was readying himself for the grand speeches to come. The Cardinal Governor looked at Tyre.
It is time, I think, to make my flock aware of what faces us.
He looked at Calder. Past time, perhaps. Tyre frowned.
There'll be unrest. Every world in the Corps will be screaming over the Vox for troops and ships that we can't give them. Let them scream. They might distract the foe.
Sir Bowden peered at the star map and stroked his beard. He looked at Calder.
How much time do you estimate we have before they arrive, brother? A few days? A week? Or only hours? If they're stopping at every world between Pergamon and here, a week, perhaps less, depending on how much of a fight the remains of the System Defense Fleet can put up.
Sir Bowden nodded thoughtfully.
Time is a valuable commodity in any campaign. The more time you have, the higher your walls grow. How much time do you need to make Almace impregnable, brother? More time than we have.
Sir Bowden laughed.
No false pride there, then. Fine. How much time to make the defences adequate for purpose?
Calder answered immediately.
2 weeks, possibly three. That I can buy you.
Sir Bowden traced a line across the hololith, causing the image to flicker.
There are a number of points between here and the enemy where we might meet them to our advantage. Give me command of the System Defense Fleet, and I'll take the Silent Horseman, Ravensvala, and half of the escorts we brought. With that, we might be able to bloody them sufficiently for our purposes.
What about Pergamon? Eamon asked.
Sir Bowden's plan would leave him only the Capulus and a handful of escorts to defend Almace. Workable, but unpleasant. Sir Bowden fixed him with a steady gaze.
You said it yourself. It is lost. But its loss will buy us the time we need to get into position. The enemy will be drugged by victory. Overconfident. Easy meat, if we are clever. You will not be able to beat them,
Calder said.
Preliminary reports put their fleet at numbers far in excess of our own.
Yes, but you are assuming their fleet will maintain integrity as it travels coreward.
Sabodan's smile was hard and cruel.
If they were us, they might. But they are not. And it will not. I have hunted this prey before, brother. They will not be able to resist the outlying worlds any more than orcs could. It is their nature to prey on the defenseless and the weak. And we will use that to our advantage.
Calder paused.
How? Refugees?
Karos interjected. Sabodan nodded.
Some always escape. Sometimes they allow them to do so, if only to prolong the hunt. So, as they hunt the refugees, we will hunt them.
He clapped his hands together.
We will drag our prey into the dark like the great cats of the plains, and the enemy will have little idea what has occurred.
Calder nodded. The White Scar's plan was simple and effective, if callous.
And if they investigate? Then we flee. We draw them off, further and further from armies. Some will press on, but we will peel away their numerical superiority, if all goes well.
Sabodan turned from the projection.
We of Chagoris are as the wind, always moving, always racing. We chill the blood and steal the breath of our foes. It runs through us and carries us to victory.
He made a fist.
Let me be the wind, Calder. I will run our foes to their deaths.
Calder gazed at the White Scar. Releasing Sabodan's brotherhood to hunt would leave him down almost a third of his force, but by the same token, forcing them behind walls had its own disadvantages. Joint operations between chapters had ever been fraught affairs. Even the most congenial of chapters had its own preferred method of war. To ignore it was to risk angering allies. Two, his command, though ordered by Gilliman himself, was a tenuous thing. He was outranked by both Sabodan and Karos. Though they had bent the knee to him thus far, they would only obey so long as their experience was not dismissed out of hand. All of this flashed through Calder's mind in moments, followed by rapid calculations.
Air power, he said. I would need pilots capable of keeping the skies clear for evacuation and extraction.
Sabodan grinned.
Of course. I can leave you as many wind riders as you like, so long as the rest of us are free to hunt the stars.
Calder nodded.
Your plan seems solid enough.
Sabodan glanced at Karos.
Ha! Solid, he says. High praise from a son of Dawn.
But I cannot give you command of the system defense fleet,
Calder added. He pointed to Aemon.
Only he can.
Sabodan wheeled about and fixed the Cardinal Governor with a patient stare.
Well,
he rumbled,
shall I take your scraps of steel and forge a blade from them?
Aemon looked away from the projection, his face tight and pale. Do I have a choice? Sabodan's smile was not friendly.
You always have a choice, Cardinal Governor. As the Quasim were known to say, the Tree of Woe has many branches.
But it has only one trunk, Aemon recited absently. Sabodan nodded.
Even so.
I will need to convene the Ecumenical Council. The things you want, I must put them before the councillors.
And if they say no?
Aemon frowned. They will not. There was an undercurrent of savage anticipation in Aemon's voice, and Calder thought of what the Cardinal Governor had said earlier. Whatever his past weaknesses, Aemon seemed determined to erase them. Calder nodded.
Good. Then we can begin.
Chapter 5, 180000. Pergamon, Secundus Grade Tithe World. Alarm klaxons pierced the air, echoing through the rock-crete halls. A tide of humanity filled the corridors of the Administratum building, shouting, shoving, weeping and whispering. Most were menial drones or ministerium scribes, about the business of their diverse masters. Palatine Sharla Cern ignored them, and they parted before her like minnows in front of a shark. They knew her, at least by reputation, and feared her. The commandery Cern led was small, less than 100 battle sisters, their remit extending only to the grounds of the Apostolic Libraria, at least in times of peace. During war, she was second in command of the planet's military. It was in that capacity that she and her bodyguards had made their way across the city from the library. The journey had not been without incident. The city was breaking down. Panic ruled the streets, despite the best efforts of the enforcers. The evacuation efforts were taking too long, and the city's defense bunkers were already full. But Cern had no time for such concerns. There were other matters that required her attention. The enemy were on their doorstep, and she intended to greet them with fire and steel. Cern was a tall woman, and willowy beneath her grey battle plate. She was young for her rank, but had earned it the hard way, as her augmetic arm attested. It was a fine thing, artfully wrought and without the glitches common to such prosthetics. Holy verses had been etched into its panels, and a miniature Promethean cylinder was hidden in the forearm. A flick of the wrist and a spurt of cleansing flame would wreathe her artificial hand. Besides the hand, she had a bolt pistol holstered at her side and a power maul in her fist. Two battle sisters of her commandery followed in her wake, bolt guns held at the ready. They swept the corridor with hard, flat gazes, and no one dared hinder them. "Witless crooks," one murmured as she stepped past a trembling scribe. Cern glanced back. "They're frightened, Cassilla. A day they thought impossible has come." Cassilla flushed slightly at Cern's chiding tone. "Forgive me, Palatine. I spoke out of turn." "There is nothing to forgive, sister. Merely keep such observations to yourself in the future. You never know who might be listening." Cern gestured upwards, where a cyber cherub crouched atop a lintel, watching them with augmetic eyes. The creatures were everywhere, on every planet of the system, or so Cern had heard. They kept watch for the Cardinal Governor, or perhaps even the Holy Synod. Or maybe they watched only because that was what they were programmed to do. Still, one could never be too careful. More than one sister had paid for the sins of a loose tongue and a free opinion. More alarms sounded. These were different in pitch. As they passed by one of the great stained glass windows that lined the far wall, Cern saw slow streaks of fire painting the night sky. "Debris alarms," Cassilla said, looking up. "They must have reached the orbital defense array." "Quicker than we expected," the other battle sister Gurna said. "They always are," Cern said. "Calculations are rarely as accurate as we might like. Remember that for the future." She stopped and turned. "There may come a time when you are in my place, with the fate of your sisters on your shoulders. Calculations, estimates, auguries, and telemetry, all of these are fallible. Only faith can be trusted. Allow it to guide you, and it will always lead you to victory." "Or to Pergamon," Cassilla said with a slight smile. "No one said victory was instantaneous," Cern said sternly. "Now be silent, both of you. We have an example to set." But as she continued down the corridor, she couldn't help but glance at the windows. The ancient glass quivered slightly in its frames. It would shatter at the first impact of the debris falling from orbit. The city itself would buckle. It might survive, but not in one piece. Streaks of slow flame stretched across the dark skies, and she wondered at their number. More than she'd expected. Too many. The attack on Pergamon had not come as a surprise to Cern. She had expected it for some time, given the warnings from Almace and Canonus Law. In the days since that first, brief astropathic message, she had worked diligently to ready her mission, and Pergamon, for war. She had commandeered vessels, organized evacuation procedures, and prepared the planetary defense levies for what was to come. But it was not enough. It was never enough. A hard lesson learned early in her days at the Schola Progenium. Time was the one commodity that could not be hoarded. It could only be spent, either foolishly or wisely. She hoped she had done the latter. "The sky is on fire, Duran," she called out as she stalked into the strategium. The chamber was circular. A glass dome surmounted the roof, its facets etched with an expensive, if inaccurate, star map of the system. Data alcoves lined the walls. Within each, a servitor, hardwired into the orbital defense array, rattled off reports in grating monotone. Officers of the planetary defense levy scrambled to calculate potential landing zones and organize Pergamon's defenders to repel the enemy.
"I had noticed, thank you."
Pernik Duran was overall commander of the levies for Pergamon, but Cern and her sisters were outside the chain of command. They'd achieved an easy equilibrium after a memorable, if grueling, bout in the training cages during her first year on Pergamon. Cern smiled thinly. "You're welcome." She waved Gurna and Cassilla back, and they took up positions to either side of the door. "How bad is it?"
"Very."
Duran was a tall man and stocky, a scion of one of the oldest Crusader houses of Terra. He showed no sign of worry, despite his assertion. He wore heavy carapace armor over a set of crimson robes and a power sword sheathed at his side.
"The defense platforms are antiques, and the enemy are not particularly bothered by losses."
Cern bared her teeth. "Neither are we." Duran smiled.
"Unfortunately, they outnumber us."
He gestured to the hololithic defense projection, flickering at the center of the chamber. A pitiful handful of tacticum analysis surrounded it, making notations and updating the projection as the servitors reported changes. Most of them were older. The upper echelons of Pergamon's military were retired, or on some form of extended punishment detail. Cern shook her head.
"Not all of them are planning to land. They never do."
"Not all, but enough. It will come down to blades."
He looked at her.
"Are your sisters ready for what is to come?"
"If we were not, I would not be here."
She slapped the bolt pistol holstered on her hip.
"We will fight them for as long as we are able."
A servitor squalled suddenly and shuddered. The withered creature thrashed in its alcove and slumped, smoke boiling from its contact nodes. Another orbital defense platform had been destroyed. The feedback was hard on the servitors. More than one hung limp from their nest of cabling and nutrient feeds.
"We've lost a third of the orbital defences,"
Duran said, as attendants hurriedly tried to douse the twitching servitor with retardant foam before it started a fire. A moment later, as another servitor convulsed and fell, Duran added,
"2/3.
He drew his blade in a whetstone. Slowly, he began to scrape the stone along the blade.
"They'll pass through the gauntlet soon, sister, and then will come a true testing of our faith."
"You look forward to it,
don't you?"
Cern ran a hand over her close-cropped hair.
"No, I am certain in my faith, but I am not certain in my ability to defend the Apostolic Libraria from the forces arrayed against us."
Duran nodded.
"We will die."
"Those are not comforting words, brother."
"We will die well,"
Cern snorted. "Better, if not by much." More alarm klaxons sounded. Impacts were being registered as the first comets of debris reached the planet's surface. The murmur of voices grew heated. Heads turned as the doors to the strategium were flung open with a dull boom.
"Oh, look, the Lord Deacon has arrived."
She gestured surreptitiously, and her bodyguards relaxed. It wouldn't do to gun down the planet's de facto ruler. Not yet, at any rate.
"At last, his wisdom has been sorely missed."
Duran's voice was utterly deadpan. Deacon Holmer was a gaunt, sallow-faced man, draped in crimson and white. He wore no crown of office, but his grey hair was pulled back from his sharp features in a tight braid. A servitor clomped in his wake, filling the air with sweet-smelling smoke from the dozens of sensors attached to its withered husk. Cyber-cherubs fluttered about him, squealing to one another in binaric, their optic sensors recording everything for posterity. He was trailed by a coterie of bodyguards and hangers-on. Cern recognized some of them, minor nobility, agri-bosses and traders, Most of their kind had fled the moment word of the enemy's approach had reached them. They joined the grand exodus of trawlers, barges, corvettes and yachts, making for the safety of Almes. Some had even volunteered to carry refugees. Once Cern had promised not to execute them and commandeer their vessels for the holy cause. Those that remained were either fools or ambitious, or both. She studied them, noting which ones seemed nervous and which seemed eager. Either might prove troublesome.
"Greetings, my Lord Deacon," Duran began.
The Crusader stepped forward and bowed.
"As you can see, we have begun..."
"What is the meaning of this?"
Holmes snarled, interrupting him.
"Why was I not informed that the attack had begun?"
"We thought it fairly self-evident," Cern said. Holmes had been her burden for almost a decade, a minor functionary given more authority than he could handle. He spent most of his time living well off whatever he could skim from the planetary tithe. He had surrounded himself with a nest of cronies and lickspittles, and paid little attention to anything that did not directly benefit him. The perfect planetary overseer, in other words. Holmes rounded on her.
"What?"
"The sky is on fire and has been for hours. You would have noticed had you stepped outside your pleasure palaces." Cern met his glare with a beatific smile. Holmes had no concept of what was occurring. For him, war meant pirates or the workers of some isolated agri-facility getting revolutionary ideas. He was scared. She could see it in his eyes. Holmes frowned.
"Canonist Law will hear of your disrespect!"
"If we survive the next few hours, I'm sure she will." Cern made to turn away, but Holmes caught her arm.
"I am the ruler of this world. You do not turn away from me."
Cern looked at his hand and then at him. He released her and backed away hastily.
"Don't threaten me," he snapped.
"Did you hear me threaten him?" she asked Duran.
"It was a very intimidating glare."
"I should have you both shot for insubordination,"
Holmes said, face flushed with embarrassment. He didn't understand that he was nothing more than a distraction now, that his authority had been superseded the moment the enemy had been sighted. She traded glances with Duran, and he frowned.
"Oh, very well," she murmured.
"Thank you," Duran said. He looked at Holmes. "As of this moment, your authority over this world has been supplanted by my own, as per ecclesiarchal dictate Signum Crucis. You will acknowledge this."
Duran waited. Holmes frowned, likely trying to recall what the particular dictate entailed. He glanced at his clique, as if considering his next move. None of them were soldiers. Duran held the reins too tightly.